I'm going to start with the set-aside prayer. God, please set aside everything I think I know about you, God, the steps, recovery, the big book, what's best for me, what's best for others. Especially help me let go of all my old ideas so I can live on your spiritual truth. Heavenly Father, thank you for your grace and mercy on me. Help me to glorify you today by carrying your message in Jesus' name, amen. Still recovering from COVID, still testing positive after 12 days, and obviously you can hear I'm still congested, but you know, otherwise just fatigue. I'm doing pretty well. I'm glad I had the booster and the vaccines, and been trying to just take it easy. I'm going to do part three on this series on the description of the alcoholic, using the information more about alcoholism. I was given the idea to do this after struggling to talk to someone about their first step and have them kind of verbalize their experience. And I realized that the first step is really what blocks most people from recovering from alcoholism. And to understand exactly what it means. And they do that in this chapter more about alcoholism. And I've spent two sessions talking about this as a disease. It's a spiritual disease, a mental disease, and a physical disease. The physical disease, we can't really change our bodies. We can't change the way we react to alcohol. We have no power to do that. I had a very interesting conversation with a sponsee last night who I haven't heard from for several weeks. And I called him. I just was inspired to call him. I think it was God. And I said, I'm going to give him a call, see what's going on. Haven't seen him at the meetings and haven't talked to him in several weeks. And I called him and he told me he was doing good, that he was going to do the Marty Mann experiment, that he was going to have 1 to 3 drinks every day and prove to himself that he could control his drinking, and that he wasn't really sure he was an alcoholic. Now, that's interesting because he's gone through a divorce and his wife filed for divorce because he couldn't stop drinking, and that he hid alcohol in the trunk of his car. He was allowed to drink beer at home, but that wasn't enough, so he had to have some in the car to drink before he came home, and then he'd have to go out and get some more. I said, normal people don't hide alcohol in the trunk of their car. Well, he said that he was only doing that because she was forcing him to do that, that he was trying to follow her rules. And then he had gone to AA in the past and had been sober for 14 months, but then he started drinking again. And then, you know, we had spent some time together. He went to AA because the drinking was out of hand and it was affecting his marriage. And then after 14 months, he started this, quote, controlled drinking, which didn't work. And she eventually told him he needed to go to AA or she was going to leave him. And then eventually they got divorced. And he worked the steps. We looked at his spiritual malady. We looked at the resentments and his fears. But then he stopped really at that point getting together with me. We didn't really go through 6 and 7 and how we apply that to our life. We didn't read 84 to 88 together. There were very infrequent calls. He was drifting away. And so he decided that he was going to do, he has 3 children, young children, that he has to take care of. for several days each week. So he wasn't going to drink on those nights, but he was going to have 1 to 3 drinks on the other nights. And then we had talked about doing his relationship inventory and making certain that he was ready to get into another relationship. And of course, he now has a Tinder friend, whatever that is. I'm old, I don't know what that is. But he didn't tell her about his going to AA and his drinking situation. And so I was trying to reason with him how he thought that, why he was trying to prove to himself that he wasn't an alcoholic. And after about 25 minutes, and I don't know if this is right or not, but having worked with a lot of people and my own experience, I realized that he wanted to prove that he wasn't an alcoholic and that she was wrong, and that she was wrong to divorce him. And so because of a resentment against his now ex-wife, he's going to prove to her that he can control his drinking. So I said, well, that's an interesting experiment, but why normal people don't try to prove that they can control their drinking? But he pointed out in the book, and I've mentioned it, and I said, well, do that experiment, but you've done that. You've done that your whole life. And ask yourself why you need to take 3 drinks at all. Now, he read 1 to 3 drinks. I thought it was 1 drink every night. And I said, eventually, you'll go a while with the 1 to 3 drinks, and then you'll say, you know, I can do that anytime. So then you'll have more one night. And then how long will it be before you're drinking when you have your 3 kids after they go to sleep? They're young. The oldest, I think, is 8. And then how long will it be before you're driving your car and you've been drinking and you're pulled over with the kids? And then how long will it be before you can't have the kids anymore? She won't trust you. And I said, your life was going pretty well. And the divorce was ended fairly amicably, and it was okay. He was fine, and he's working. He's a professional. He has a very good job. He's a very nice young man. He's 30. I think he's 35. I said, now, when you're doing this experiment to prove you're not an alcoholic, do you see the consequences if this experiment goes wrong? And then he said, well, I can quit. I quit and went to AA for 14 months, and I quit this last time. I said, but you quit, but you're drinking now. And how do you know you'll be able to quit? And what are the consequences? So I could clearly see after that conversation last night, and I hope this is helpful, and I'm not criticizing in any way the disease of alcoholism, how you can't see the truth from the false. You can't recall the humiliation and defeat. You can't think through the first drink. It's not possible. And so I asked him last night, why doesn't he decide just not to drink ever again? Why does he feel the need to drink? And maybe that his life would be better. And pray God and ask God his will for you. And see what it is. And he was supposed to get back to me. But I prayed for him very earnestly last night. I just prayed for him this morning that God would open his mind, that the grace of God would come in and help him see the truth of his situation. Because I don't think this is a good experiment. I don't think this is a good idea for him. But I can't convince him of that. He has to be convinced. But I thought that was so interesting. I haven't heard that before. I've worked with a lot of people. I've been fired a lot, which I don't know that that's good or bad, because I try to force people to follow directions in the book and to be accountable. And a lot of people don't want to do that. And this was a man who was very committed, did fairly thorough work, but then started to drift away. And, you know, that's what's described in this chapter. You know, we just finished Jim, who suddenly had the thought that he could have whiskey and milk and it would be okay. And he vaguely sensed it was not too smart. And I think this young man vaguely sensed that this experiment was not too smart. Because I said to him, well, why did you call me before you started the experiment? Well, he knew what I was going to say. See, he didn't want to hear the truth. He wanted to believe his thinker. And I was really glad. I was thankful to the Lord that I was able to talk to him. Maybe I was able to help him. But I told him, the door is open. Call me anytime. If this doesn't work, I want to be there for you. Don't be embarrassed. I still love you. Try to seek God's guidance in this situation. And we've read about Jim, and he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic and the intense physical and mental suffering which drinking always caused him. And he pushed it all aside in favor of milk with whiskey, that would work. And that conversation last night just really hammered home the insanity of alcoholism. And it says here, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. You know, you cannot see the truth. And the lack of the proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else. And it shows that you can be an alcoholic and suffer from alcoholism. You can lose a marriage. You can see how you can't stop drinking. And yet, last night was the first time in my experience where someone who was an alcoholic and who had suffered decided after a while in working the steps that they were going to prove that they weren't an alcoholic. And they're trying to prove to themselves, because of a resentment, that they are okay. And it says in the book that we have to fully concede their innermost selves that we're alcoholic. The idea that we'll be like normal people has to be smashed. And how does somebody go from an alcoholic to trying to have controlled drinking? Now, most people who drink again, they don't try to prove that they're not alcoholics. They drink and then they say, well, I was sober for a while and I can always go back to AA. And he told me the same thing. And I said, well, you don't know that. Because we don't know, once we start drinking again, that we'll ever get back. We don't know. And we read The Man of 30. And after 30 years, he started drinking again and he died. And so, when you're separated from God and you're living on self-will, you can't see the truth about your life. And that's what happens. You can work the steps, you can put a lot of effort into it, but if you start drifting away, you stop calling people, you stop going to meetings, you start to get these thoughts that aren't true. And you're dominated by your self-will and your self-centeredness. And then remember, it says we made decisions based on self that cause us to be harmed. And they talk about that this Jim may be an extreme case, and that sometimes people have reflected upon the consequences before they took the drink. And I tried to point out to him some of the consequences of this experiment. And he says, well, that may be true, but he's not concerned about that. And here's a key line in the big book. I don't think it's discussed at any meeting I've been to, but it's a key line. It says, but there was always, always the curious mental phenomenon. And the picture they paint here is you have this mental phenomenon, something that cannot be explained, that's parallel with your sound reasoning. So you have sound reasoning, and then you have this curious mental phenomenon. They're competing, and they're parallel. And then there inevitably arises some insane, trivial excuse or thought for taking the first drink. So you always have sound reasoning, and this is without God. You have your sound reasoning, your willpower, your mind, but this curious mental phenomenon that's going on in parallel with this. Think about it. You have two parts of your brain. One's sound reasoning, the other's the curious mental phenomenon. And then the insane trivial excuse is some emotional buildup that gives you a trivial excuse that overcomes the sound reasoning, and it always, always does. And that's why we don't have a defense against the first drink. And so our sound reasoning fails to hold in check. The insane idea will always win out. And the reason I'm doing this series is because maybe it'll help someone. It's helping me. Maybe it helped that man last night, that I will always be powerless over alcohol. I will never have really control over how much I drink, and I will never have the power of choice without God. So I have a spiritual illness that requires a spiritual solution, because the solution to not taking the first drink has to come from living a life centered on God, serving Him and His children, playing the role He assigns, staying close to Him. And when I see things that I don't like and I get disturbed, I go to God rather than to alcohol. I'm substituting one spirit for another. And then it says when the insane idea wins out, people ask, how could it happen? Now it says, in some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified, notice that word, by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. So nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like is what the spiritual malady looks like. Living a life run on self-will. We get nervous, angry, worried, depressed, jealous, or the like. And then we justify drinking to relieve that, because it's not fair. Life's not treating me fair. So I'm getting nervous or angry or worrying or depression. And it's really a combination of self-pity. And so it justifies our taking the first drink. And it says, even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insane, insufficient of the light of what always happened. But you can't see what's going to happen. And you can't justify, you can justify the insane idea of drinking because you can't see what's always happened, because you're filled with the emotions of the spiritual illness, which is nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, the like. You can add on. And it says, when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrible consequences may be. And now they're going to use the example of the jaywalker, which a lot of people like. And it's very powerful, and I don't know where they got this idea from, but it really symbolizes the whole disease of alcoholism. And our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion safe for jaywalking. And when I was talking to that young man last night, I thought his behavior was absurd and incomprehensible from what he had talked to me and we had seen and I knew about his whole life. And it was absurd and incomprehensible, but I couldn't get him to see it. And it's the first drink, it's not the second drink. As an individual with a passion for jaywalking. And a passion is a strong, barely controlled emotion. So someone decides that jaywalking is a good idea. And he gets a thrill, so he gets some spiritual benefit, some relief, excitement, pleasure out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. And this excitement and this thrill that you get when you start drinking overcomes the emotions and treats the emotions of living a life run on self-will. And he enjoys himself for a few years, and most people do, in spite of friendly warnings. Well, people start to give you some warnings that maybe your behavior is not normal. Maybe you don't drink like other people. Maybe the way you react when you drink is abnormal. Maybe it's starting to bother your relationships. Up to this point, you will label him as foolish chap, having queer ideas of fun. So we might be labeled foolish chaps, and we have queer ideas of fun. Maybe drinking alone in the basement. That's what I did. That's a queer idea of fun. You know, why would people, normal people don't go and drink in the basement, I guess. Most, I don't know. Maybe they do. We have strange ideas of fun. And this idea of jaywalking starts to have power over him. And it's the thrill, it's the benefit. He gets something out of running in front of fast cars. So sober, he can't not run in front of fast cars because he needs that ease and comfort that we get from the first drink. He gets it from running in front of cars. Now they use this example because it's so preposterous. And then luck deserts him, and we get slightly injured several times in succession. Did you get injured by your drinking? Did it cause problems in your relationship? You know, the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic when they get the DUI, you've all heard this, they're both in jail and they're in two different cells. And the non-alcoholic says, boy, I wish I hadn't had that last couple drinks. I wish I'd taken a cab. And the alcoholic says, gee, I shouldn't have taken the interstate. And you see the difference? And it says you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. You start getting hurt. Your relationships, consequences. That you would cut back, and people do. They say they're going to quit. They're never going to drink again. And so, but he's hit again. And this time he has a fractured skull. And when you look back to your life, did the consequences keep getting worse? And the consequences to me were bad decisions based on self. I made a lot of bad decisions in relationships. And I lived in constant fear, and it was just horrible. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. So he gets to the hospital, he goes to treatment. So he goes to treatment, and as soon as he gets out, he's running in front of the trolley car. And the reason is because he can't live sober without running. He can't live without running in front of the car, and an alcoholic can't live without drinking. We have no defense against the first drink. We can't recall at certain times the humiliation defeat. And we have to hammer this home to ourselves. Me talking about it isn't going to help somebody out there unless they can see it's their experience. This is the experience of powerless over alcohol, 100%. Never be able to take one drink. Once I start drinking, I'll never stop. And I have no power on my own because they're getting ready to transition us from the not drinking book to the God book. And that's, I'm going to do my next talk at home on that, the transition from the not drinking book to the God book. Because that's coming up in the beginning of More About Alcoholism. But they're hammering home, they're going to hammer home our powerlessness. He tells you he has decided to stop jaywalking for good. He takes the solemn oath, but he can't follow through on it. And in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. And then this goes on. Now, why can't he follow through on the decision? Because he has no power to not jaywalk. And on through the years, this conduct continues. And you see, we have to understand, I'll never have power. I have to live with a different power. It can't be mine. And I have to live with a power that will give me power over alcohol and power to change the way I see things and power to change the way I react and power so that I can treat my emotions and go from self-centered to God-centered without taking alcohol. And he promises to stay off the streets altogether. And finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and he's held up to ridicule. He's losing his wife. He's losing his job. He tries every known mean to get jaywalking out of his head, to get the obsession out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. He has a scheme. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? And what does it take, I wrote, to be defeated? What does it take to see your powerlessness? Not only over alcohol, but over managing your life. The two are related. If I'm going to continue to manage my life, I'll never have power over alcohol. The hyphen in the first step is why people die. They can see that a lot of people can see that they can't drink and they're powerless over alcohol, but they can't see that it's managing their life. They're never going to have power over alcohol. They need to have a new manager. And what I say is I have to fire me. It says, you may think our illustration too ridiculous, but is it? We have been through the ringer. Have you been through the ringer? Have to admit, if you substituted alcoholism, you can substitute any addiction for jaywalking. The illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? And I could see the insanity of alcoholism last night when I was talking to this young man. After all he's been through, and all that he had admitted to himself, he's lost his first step, and he thinks he's going to try to prove that he's not an alcoholic. It's insane. Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to. Now, you hear that in meetings. People, a lot of new people want to tell you that it's not that bad. You know, they still have a good job. They were this and that. They don't have a DUI. They still have a house. They still have this. Well, it's not circumstances that make your life unmanageable. It's not circumstances that make you hitting bottom. It's that feeling inside where you see that you have no power to change how you're living. You have no power to not drink. That you have fear, you have anger, you don't feel good, you're irritable, restless, and discontent. You don't want to go on living like that anymore. Because the circumstances can keep getting worse and worse. where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. And it says, and the people who say they've not gone the extremes, and I like this, for we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. Now, what does that mean, that you understand yourself so well? Did you understand that every time you drank and every time you used, things got bad, so you're not going to do it? That means that you have the control of choice. You have choice. Now, if you are a real alcoholic, an addict, you have a disease that only a spiritual illness can conquer. You've passed through the line, crossed the line where you can recover on a non-spiritual basis, and they can't see it. They think they understand themselves so well that they can recover on a non-spiritual basis, and that's why I think it all relates to taking the first step. If you really haven't taken the first step 100%, you don't continue to take it, you begin to regain control. You think you have some power, and you want to stay powerless. You want to stay powerless over alcohol in your mind. You want to stay powerless over managing your life. You don't want to take credit for being in control anymore, choice. You want to give all the credit to God. You just want to be a God seeker. Remember, the highest office in AA is trusted servant. And what's our real purpose in AA? It says it's to fit ourselves on page 77. I've read this 18 trillion times. I'll read it again. My real purpose all the time is to fit myself to be of maximal service to God and the people about me. I have to fit myself. I have to do prayer and meditation inventory. I have to live on pages 84 to 88. If you're new, you have to put your life in order with steps 1, 2, and 3, with your with God, 4, 5, 6, and 7 with your mind, and 8 and 9 with the world. And then you have to continue to do that all the time to fit yourselves to be a maximum service to God and others. Remember, if you're not in fit spiritual condition, you can't see the truth about alcohol. And it says, we have not lost everything in life through drinking, not yet, and we don't intend to. Well, I don't think anybody intended to have their whole life ruined. But then when it is, they say, how'd that happen? And they can't see that it was them. When they come to AA, it's usually other people's fault. But they can't say it's them, and living a life run on extreme self-will. And it says there may be certain non-alcoholic people who, though drink foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. And, you know, I don't know that this young man I talked to last night, and I hope people aren't upset with me talking about it, I don't know that he's truly an alcoholic. What he told me in his life and his description, he is. But maybe he can control how much he drinks. Maybe it'll work out for him, I don't know. I'm hopeful that it does, if that's his decision, but we'll have to see. He has to come to his own truth. My first sponsor, Cliff, used to say, buy him more booze. And he used to hear that, just drink more. And because alcohol will bring you to your knees if you're a real alcoholic. And he says the brains and bodies have not been as damaged as much as ours were, so you could able to stop reminding. And that means that you don't have the obsession of the mind and you don't have the allergy of the body. But here's squiggly writing. And this is really important, and I'll end with this. The actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. Absolutely unable. Self-knowledge, awareness of myself, my willpower, my self-will, understanding triggers, avoiding schemes to combat my alcoholism that involve me and a plan, my plan. I'll never be able to stop drinking. I don't have the power. What knowledge do I need to stop drinking? Knowledge of God. And that's why we agnostics is those without knowledge of God. So we go from here, we can't stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge, to two pages later, where it says we agnostic, those without knowledge of God. So we have to go from self-knowledge, which won't work, to God knowledge, which will work. And it's knowledge of God's ability to work in my life. Knowledge of God has a power that can do for me what I cannot do for myself. Knowledge of God's will for me and the power that I carry out. Having a vision of his will in all my affairs. And they say this is a point we wish to emphasize and reemphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers. It has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Has it been revealed to you? And then it follows with Fred, which I did several weeks ago. And then Fred did recover, and this chapter ends after Fred's story. It says, many doctors, this is how they end the not drinking book, what I call the not drinking book. Because on page 44 in We Agnostics, they talk about the spiritual solution three times on that page. And then they talk about, we're going to talk about God on page 45. And I'm going to record one on that. Because I think it's missed. There's a turning point in the book. From the step one, powerless, to understanding that you have an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And therefore, we're going to talk about God. So it says, they say, what you say about the general hopelessness of the average, this is on page 43, average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to the two of you men whose stories I've heard, there's no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Had you offered yourself as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you. So they could already see that they're 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Most doctors, doctors today, they send everybody to AA. They don't have a solution. And they send this to AA because they want to get you out of their office.